My guest is artist Keith Haring. He is now paid tens of thousands of dollars to do the kind of work he used to get arrested for. Haring's early work took its cue from New York City subway graffiti. He made the rounds of subway stations doing quick chalk sketches on train station walls. The designs were cartoon-like human figures, barking dogs, hearts, crawling babies. Rush Hour provided a bigger audience for his work than any gallery or museum could. Word spread, and Haring became an important part of the East Village art scene. His work was shown in galleries, and its value began to rise. He became something of an art superstar, but he continued to insist that his work have a life outside of the art world. He painted colorful murals on walls and buildings, created public sculpture, and decorated rock clubs. Last year, he opened his pop shop, where he sells items like T-shirts, radios, and refrigerator magnets, imprinted with his colorful, cartoon-like designs. Keith Haring is in Philadelphia today, working with teenagers on a neighborhood wall mural. I spoke with him yesterday, and he told me what it was about graffiti that excited him when he moved to New York City.
Well, first of all, I got there in 78, which was really prime time for this subways being painted in New York. A lot of that has since changed. But for me, coming from growing up in a small town in Pennsylvania, first of all, and then living in Pittsburgh for a short period, and coming to New York, one of the reasons I came to New York was to look for my peers, sort of, or find other people that were working with a similar intensity and coming from the same generation, because I wasn't really finding that where I was in Pittsburgh, and I wasn't around people that really, inspiring me or making, challenging me to make me do more things. And immediately after coming to New York, although I was going to galleries and seeing other things also, one of the things that struck me most was the work in the subway. Because at that time, like I said, trains were really, almost every train was painted, and they were really beautiful.
Like murals on the sides of whole train cars.
Yeah, like the entire car is usually sometimes inside and out. And it was in a way very pop. I mean, the characters using colors and cartoon characters, which had come out of, I think, the whole generation of people that were growing up with really good cartoons on television and really good sort of pop culture.
So you wanted to do something that was your version of that kind of expression?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, for the first 2 years, I didn't do anything on the street. I mean, I was sort of watching and appreciating it, but not, my thing that I wanted to not do was to sort of jump on the bandwagon and copy their style or do something that looked as if it was just an imitation or something of what I was seeing on the trains. So the first time that I did something in the street was really only when I had discovered something that I thought made sense to be on the street. Because although I had a lot of things in common with these graffiti things, because my whole background had really been in cartooning, and so my concept and sense of the line and of the scale that I was seeing there and of the sense of color, etc., was very much in tune with them, but there was also something that was distinctly different in the kind of drawings that I was starting to do. And it was really only when I started drawing these sort of images, which in the beginning were just human images and animals and spaceships and pyramids and things in different combinations and juxtapositions, it was only then that I really had something to put on the subway. Because before that, I had been doing only abstract drawings, sort of, doing, I guess, pseudo-abstract expressionist or sort of gestural abstract drawings, which didn't make sense to me to be on the street. But as soon as I had this vocabulary kind of images, it almost necessitated that it should be on the street.
One of the things you were doing was drawing in subway stations.
That started after I had come up with these characters, and then by accident sort of discovered that there were all these empty panels in the subway inside the station where they usually have advertisements. When they don't have enough ads, they cover the space with empty black paper to cancel out the old ad. And although they had probably been there for years, one day I felt like I had discovered it, because I had never seen anyone draw on it before. And it immediately seemed like the perfect place to draw. First of all, because I could draw very quickly because these things I was drawing were very simple and very, very quick sort of, you know, line drawings. And also because it was a very borderline case between being legal and illegal, you know, because it wasn't right on the wall and because I was drawing with chalk, it was sort of a delicate sort of situation when I would get caught, because it was hard to really say that you were defacing because you were drawing with chalk, and also you were drawing on a paper panel that would inevitably be changed and replaced within a week or 2 weeks.
What was your plan when you started doing this? Did you figure out which subway stations to hit and have an organized scheme for covering the city?
It really didn't start with a plan. I mean, it started almost, like I said, by accident, and in the beginning was something I did on my way to work when I'd be riding the trains, and was more a hobby in the beginning. After about a month or two, and the increased sort of interest in it and the response I was getting from passerbys, etc., I started to do it more as a full-time thing, and after a period of a year, it became almost like a science. I mean, I drew in the subway from 1980 to 1985, and after the first year or two, I was so well organized with it that I would know when to do a line and what time of day to do it and sort of how quickly to do it and how to avoid, you know, getting caught by cops, etc. And also had undertaken having them photographed, you know, systematically. Like I had a friend who named Sang Kwang Chi, who was a photographer, who would, after I would do a route, I would usually do two or three routes a week, but after I'd do a route, I'd call him up and tell him which stations I would do, and he'd go out and systematically photograph as many of them as he could. So over 5 years, we've accumulated thousands of photographs of these different drawings.
Artist Keith Haring is my guest. Did it get to the point where graffiti writers started noticing your stuff and try to find you?
Yeah, that happened really right away. One of the things for me to start was that I was almost more concerned about getting the approval or respect of the other graffiti writers than I was of the people in the art world or the, you know, other writers of the subway, because to me the biggest challenge was to do what I was doing in a way that it would not be looked at as something that was fake or was a copy or was outside of what they were doing. And so to me it was very important to win the respect of other graffiti artists in the way that I did it and the just the similar attitude and the way that I approached it and the ways I would and would not draw, etc. So it was something that was really important to me, and it also has been a kind of a lasting thing. I mean, I still, through all the things that have happened since then, and even after now I've stopped drawing the subway, but I still have probably more respect from so-called graffiti writers than I do from other fellow artists that I was sort of emerging from at that same time.
You were fined several times by the police and I think arrested once?
I was arrested several times and fined several times. But in those cases, a lot of times it would start out being a little bit scary, but it would end up being a really amusing situation because the cop who caught me usually didn't know who I was, but when he would take me to the station, a lot of times we'd find out that other policemen in the station were eager to find out who this person was, because after a year or two, everyone that rode the subways knew the drawings, you know, because if you rode the subway, and, you know, even just once a week, you'd see at, you know, several drawings, and this went on for a 5-year period. So I had a large following of people in the subway, many of which were policemen that spent their time in the subway, that were very eager to find out who I was. I had a great, actually, one of my favorite stories was coming out of a restaurant with Andy Warhol when we were eating, and a cop came up to him and wanted his autograph. And Andy was always, the first thing Andy would always do is introduce the other people. He was always sort of playing down his own importance and saying, you know, well, you have to, here, you should get his autograph because he's a famous graffiti artist. And the cop said, really? And the cop was in uniform. He started taking out his ticket book. And so I sort of looked at Andy like, what, he's, you know, he can't give me a ticket now for something I did before. And he opened the ticket book, and on the inside of the ticket book was a sticker with my Radiant Baby thing on it. So it was sort of, you know, it sort of turns up in funny places. You know, so I actually had a lot of cops that were fans at the same time.
You know, one thing that I think some people have wondered is, you've done graffiti and become really famous for that and for your subsequent work. Some people feel that somehow you had the advantage over graffiti writers because you were a white, middle-class, art-trained person. Mm. I don't know, how do you feel when people say that about you in a critical way?
People have a lot of misguided ideas about graffiti, first of all. First of all, just the definition of graffiti, but about what you're talking about, a lot of people, first of all, assume that only black and Hispanic kids do graffiti, which is completely not true, and the kids that do graffiti only come from poor neighborhoods, etc. I mean, a lot of the best graffiti writers in New York were from white middle class or upper class families. It had nothing to do necessarily with what background you came from. And also for me, there's of course some truth in that matter, that when I would get caught, it was definitely to my advantage that I looked like a, you know, I had glasses and I was a white boy and didn't look like someone that was going to cause trouble, etc. So I could sort of take that and use it to my advantage. I mean, there are people like Michael Stewart who got beat to death by police not because he was writing graffiti, but because he was black. I've had cops say very racist things to me, say like you should be glad you're white, or we'd be blah blah blah. You know, most black and Puerto Rican kids that I know that have gotten caught, even some kids that were drawing with chalk on the panels, have gotten beaten up. I mean, it is very common that the first thing they do is they beat you up and then ask questions. So I definitely used the situation to my advantage, but I don't think that was wrong. I mean, I was as aware of the situation as anyone else, but I don't think that, I don't know, I think that everyone has sort of an equal opportunity to do things with, what if, you know, if I had done the kind of drawings I was doing and had done it in the way I was doing it, it wouldn't have mattered what color I was necessarily. When I did things out of the, you know, the thing that made my work, I guess, more universal or on another level was not the fact that it was graffiti. Graffiti played, in reality, a very small role in the overall picture of my work. The graffiti was one way that I got it out to a group of people. But the fact that it was graffiti isn't what made my work popular or made me famous. The work itself is the only thing that had that power. So it was really the drawing itself, not where the drawing was done, that was the power of the work.
You stopped working on the subways in 1985. Briefly, why did you give that up?
Well, first of all, 85, if you look at the things that were happening to me in my quote-unquote career, 85 was very late to have given that up. I mean, I could have easily stopped in 82, and because by that point I was already making a living from the paintings, etc., that I was doing. So for me to continue to even to 85 was sort of past the point when I really had to, for if I was only seeking fame and attention. And in a way, it is one of the things that I miss the most, because it was a very direct and very, very real thing, sort of very real connection with people and a very, very sort of genuine kind of art experience that you would have with
it's all
totally
kinds
outside
of people.
Of
the gallery and museum.
Yeah. But it became, first of all, by 1985, I was starting to not only deal with New York City, but try to deal with the whole world, which meant that I had to spend time in a lot of other countries. And just physically, there was not time to be in the subway in New York because I wasn't in New York. Also, people by that time were very aware of how much the drawings were worth, whether they were on chalk and in the subway or not. If you could peel a drawing off, you could resell it for a few thousand dollars. So this became more and more of a popular thing for people to come in and remove them with a putty knife. And for me, that was sort of not, it was reaching the whole, you know, it was the wrong point. It wasn't what I was doing them for. And it became necessary to start to do the public things on permanent surfaces that couldn't be removed, like the building I'm doing here on concrete, you know.
Artist Keith Haring is my guest, and he started working in the New York City subways, but his work has branched out to museum galleries, amusement parks around the world. We'll talk more about his recent work after this short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with artist Keith Haring. One of the projects you've taken on in the past year is a store in which you sell T-shirts and buttons and other items with
toys,
your
coloring books, posters, etc.
with your designs on them,
yeah.
And even the walls of the store are painted
right.
by you in your designs. And this has been very controversial in the art world. Some people think it's really exciting to get your work out on common objects mm-hmm. like T-shirts, and other people think it's a sign that you've really sold out mm-hmm. and made your art into the equivalent of designer jeans.
Right. yes, the in a way that actually the pop shop is probably the best way to explain maybe the overall idea or of how this whole sort of other venture into the real world how it came about or why it's important to me. For me, it was not something that was a matter of choice. If I was being honest to myself, and more importantly, honest to the work itself, to the drawings, and to even down to the way the line itself, the kind of line, the kind of image that I was creating, then the pop shop grew out of something that for me was inevitable. The same way that when the drawings of these images, which were about communicating information and ideas, existed, and then because they existed, they almost by the nature of themselves, they demanded to be in public, which made them be in the subway. In the same way, once they were in the subway and had effectively started to communicate and become part of the consciousness of not only New York City, but then through magazines and video and television to the world, it also necessitated that I continue with that idea and pursue it in a way that was honest to myself and to that thing, in that definitely I could have, and very easily, I guess, hidden within the safety of the art world and stayed in my studio and produced paintings, and which sell on the art market for very inflated prices, because that's what the art market is about. That's a whole other question. But the for me, it was inside the work itself that it was not owned by me. It was bigger than me, and it was something that should be part of the whole world. And the only way to really make that happen was to do things, first of all, things through commercial publication, meaning sometimes album covers or advertising and magazines, but also to make things on things which people could have, so that people could have a piece of this whole thing.
So you don't see it as commercializing your art, you see it as making your art accessible to people who don't have the money to buy
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't, of course, cannot deny that it is not commercializing it, because that's the way the world works. I mean, you can't, it's impossible to give away things to everyone, right? I mean, I have spent a lot of time doing giveaway things also. I mean, printing posters and giving them away for free at rallies, anti-nuclear things or Free South Africa, etc., or giving away badges and little things like that. But to really get it and make some real impact into other people's minds and the world, etc., and culture, the only way to really have any effect on that was to work within that system. I mean, you can't really be outside of a system and criticize it or comment on it and change it or have any impact without being inside of it and sort of working through the same mechanics of that system.
You were good friends with the late Andy Warhol, and he was really the master of mass-produced mm-hmm. art. Did you get any advice from him on the kind of undertaking that you've done with
well,
the pop shop? Advice on merchandising your art or on mass producing it?
Not necessarily specific things, but Andy was always full of encouragement. And I mean, yeah, well, actually, we discussed lots of ideas, but and discussed almost everything, I guess. I mean, because we'd talk about different things, but Andy was would generally support almost anything that you said. So it was sort of hard to get really a critical answer out of him. But more than by conversation, I learned a lot of things from Andy just by watching and by example. I mean, Andy was one of the best sort of teachers of people just by what he was saying one sentence, or just by example. He was a kind of incredible philosopher that a lot of people looked up to and learned things from. At the same time, watching the way that the art world, the quote unquote established art world and art market, treated Andy, I also learned a lot of things about the risks and the dangers of doing that. But for me, anything worth doing is worth taking a risk. I mean, if you look at a painting of Andy Warhol's now, even after his death, a side of a painting by Jasper Johns or something like that, the prices are they have nothing to do with each other. But for me, the value of something cannot be determined by something like the art market or the art world. And the value of Warhol is tenfold greater than a Jasper Johns ever will be. The amount of people and the amount of effect that he has had on the culture and the world and thinking is incredible.
You've become one of the celebrities of the art world, and I wonder if that's a mixed blessing for you, and if some people love you for it and other people hate you for the status you've achieved.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think everything is a mixed blessing in a way, but especially when you get picked out of a group of people that are sort of singled out, yours are going to have to deal with that, of that being scrutinized and being picked apart sort of for every little thing that you do. I think for me it was a blessing because it was part of the idea of what I was trying to do. I mean, to really be effective as an artist, and all of a sudden to have this outlet where I have access to all kinds of avenues of communication, from television to computers to magazines, etc. It was, you know, for me it was great, because in a way that I was hoping to be creating something that was beyond the traditional idea of what an artist does.
When you're famous and when you have a talent, many people want a piece of it. And I know you get offers from around the world for commissions, for designs, for everything from tote bags to buildings, probably. And you're in the position of having to decide what's worth your time and what you're interested in and what isn't worth your time and you're not interested in. Do you have any standard that you could communicate, or is it a case-by-case thing?
It's pretty much case-by-case, but for me, it's interesting that it has become almost a part of my art. I mean, it becomes an aesthetic decision and an overall decision, everything that you decide. I mean, I spend most of my time deciding what not to do, because in a lot of people's eyes, especially the people that have been critical and will say things like that I sold out, etc., if they had any idea of the kinds of things that I could have done and the kinds of things that I have turned down, and many of which for large sums of money, they would have a complete different understanding. And that's why in time, I think when people understand the broader picture of what kinds of possibilities there were, the way that I could have existed in the world and the choices that I made, everything has been a very careful decision. And I mean, half of the things, maybe not half, but at least a third of the things I do for no money at all.
I guess one of the things that probably surprised a lot of people was the vodka ad that you did the illustration for.
Well, actually, it's funny because that's the only commercial thing that I've done in the United States. I've done things in Europe and in Japan, even more things in all over Europe, and select things. I mean, something for Rank Xerox and things for different things. But the vodka ad, I actually got into because of Andy. Andy had done the ad for Absolute Vodka last year, and Andy actually suggested the idea to me and asked me if I wanted to do it.
This is Andy Warhol.
Me, the fact that Andy had done it first had totally okayed it for me. Although there are things that Andy also did that I wouldn't do after him, but the people that were doing the vodka ad were very, they you know, they were sort of genuine about it and were very clean. One interesting thing, which actually I just happened to me last week, found out that I was talking to a friend that's in jail in Rikers Island, and it was telling me that that he had my Absolut Vodka ad up on his wall in the cell, right? And all of a sudden it dawned on me that anything anyone negative could say about me was totally washed away just by that, because the fact that that was maybe the only way that my art could have gotten into inside of a prison or places where people are really have no other access to any kind of thing, but that he could have taken it out and put it on his wall and it was still art. I mean, it was, and so, you know, it was totally effective, even if it only got to that one person.
We only have about a minute left, so I'm going to ask you this briefly. You're in Philadelphia now, painting a mural in one of the neighborhoods, on a wall.
Yeah, the side of a building.
Side of a building. Now, you've done a lot of murals on walls of handball courts, on sides of buildings in New York and in other cities. Before you go in and do a mural in a community, do you feel out the community first? Or not? Do you want to have a sense of approval before you go in and paint it?
In New York City, definitely. Because I'm not from Philadelphia, I didn't have the opportunity to do that, but I let it in the hands of people here from Brandywine Workshop who have done many murals in Philadelphia. The only request that I had when I talked to people here was that I did not want to do it in a shopping area or inside a mall kind of thing. I wanted to do it in a real neighborhood, preferably in a schoolyard or hospital, something like that, or in a neighborhood that was really a neighborhood where real people lived and where they needed something better, you know, instead of something that was in the middle of a shopping area where it would just, you know, make a nice area even nicer. Because I think the most important place to put things, especially when they're volunteer things, is places that really need them. So I have done a lot of hospitals and a lot of areas in New York, mostly in you know, funky areas, I guess.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thanks for being here. My guest has been artist Keith Haring. His colorful cartoon-like designs can be seen on walls, T-shirts, buttons, and canvases around the world. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.